for me to learning things. I was just seeing things this week, so I thought that I'd bring this topic of just what the Buddha, or how the Buddha saw the mind, to our discussion tonight, and perhaps also as an opportunity to use, you know, what we're talking about here in the meditation when we come to do that in a little while. Because it's a really important question, actually, just how the Buddha actually did see the mind. Where is this mind that we all think that we know about? We certainly we know that we have a brain, and well, I think most medicos would probably say that the brain is everything that there is. The brain is really what creates this world and everything around us. But we know, once we start to meditate, that this becomes very problematic. Actually, when we are starting to think in terms like that. And there was a show last night, I don't know who else might have seen it, but on the ABC Catalyst had a program on perception and just what the brain does with perception. And it really very clearly showed that that there's a lot of stuff that's made up, a lot of stuff that's conditioned, a lot of stuff that's habitual in the brain that we kind of use and form to make the world, create the world that we want to see. And basically this is really what the Buddha was talking about too. He was, when he was sort of teaching about the mind and just how it all works, he was always kind of reminding us that the mind is something that's inside. You know, that from the very start, from the very beginning, he talked about seeing all that he saw, all of his teachings, he said came out of the inside of his fathom-length body. You know, and as I've mentioned here probably many times before, he wasn't much interested in the world that's out there, this world that we so passionately believe in. And once you start to meditate, you can just start to see a little bit. You get little peeks in from around the edges, and that you gradually get to see, yeah, you know, the Buddha's onto something here. There's something that's really quite strange about this external world. You know, where is the reality of it? And as this program on the ABC last night was showing, is that this is very a very difficult thing to point to, because really there isn't any reality that's there in the external world. And I'm certainly not saying that it's not necessarily true. It's apparently true when we kind of look out there. What we see apparently is indeed this world that's there. But this world that's there is, it really depends so much on our perception, on the way that we perceive and perceive the world that we believe in, but also just how we feel about those perceptions. And indeed the Buddha's teachings very much goes to this this way of seeing things. When we look at his five aggregates, the aggregations that he talked about that make up all that we are. And as I've sort of mentioned here a few times before, there's five of those, and there's the fifth one is just still consciousness, and I keep on sort of talking about each week too. We're really interested in still consciousness, or stillness of mind, because this is really where we try to go to in meditation, to practice to be still in our mind so that we can actually develop the clarity. The stillness brings the clarity to us so that we can actually start to understand and see some of these deeper things that are there for us to notice. But then from the fifth canto, coming down to just the next one, which is just the movement of this consciousness, the way that consciousness moves. And when consciousness moves, it's very different than when it's still. You're already starting to make a creation, to bring into the world, into your world, you're starting to bring in a creation. a creation of this movement. And then the third aggregate is perception. So once that movement starts to happen, then our mind just naturally perceives. We start to probably it's really more of an intellectual thing. I think this perception. It's really we've got this brain, and we can really create whatever we want to create. We can see things the way that we want to see them. And this, you know, I think it's very apparent in the world too. You know, even just with the way when we're looking at our differences and the problems that we have with relationships, and just sort of seeing things as one. It's very rare for people to see us to see something as one. Most of us sort of see things differently from the next person. We have views and opinions in that way, and we. And our perceptions are really quite different. And, you know, in a way real. I mean, I've had plenty of experience in my life too, just where there's been a perception of something that's been totally wrong, even though I might have thought that it was an absolutely accurate way of sort of seeing whatever I saw that movement of consciousness, but then to realise that the perception of that was just totally wrong. But then, coming back to the second aggregate, we get back to feeling. Feeling's always very important. Feeling is really one of the foundations of mindfulness too, just where we do, especially feelings inside the body, just feeling how we are. Very, very important component of these aggregations. And then, of course, the first aggregation is really the way that everything coalesces into this external world. So this perception and the feeling we have is very important, because it's that, those perceptions and those feelings that create our view of the world. And if you just think back to the first two of the Eightfold Noble Path, the first two factors of that are right view, having the right view, and then right intention. So you can see that these perceptions and these feelings that we have, as they do manifest into this physical form, it's very important, because it's forming our view of the world, our view that this world is out there and it's real. These views, you know, it seems so obvious, doesn't it? It's not something that you would necessarily want to dispute. But it's really when we have those fixed perceptions and fixed view of this world in the way that I'm describing it here, that you really do, I think, miss quite a bit of the way that the Buddha was teaching. Because he was really, the Buddha was very rebellious. He was a rebel. He wasn't anyone that was necessarily trying to go along with the status quo or trying to to put things together just to so that everything would work out fine and everything would be all right. He was a definite rebel. He was telling us and teaching us to look at these perceptions, to look at the world, look at the way that it is. And of course, this is the way that he brought in his meditation, and the particular way that he teaches the meditation, this idea of teaching to get to the stillness of mind, so that we know very clearly and completely what still consciousness is. And when that still consciousness does start to be with us in our meditation, and then even from meditation, this still consciousness, of course, extends into our everyday life, and we can live our life with this stillness right there. We can live our life with stillness as a datum point in our lives to be able to reflect from. So it becomes really very, very important to start to practice to see this. And again, you know, as I've been talking about as well, we've just talked about mindfulness there, and there's and we'll sort of look at this too when we start the meditation in a minute, but mindfulness again, just there's four foundations of mindfulness, And the first foundation is just to looking at the body, knowing, being mindful of your body. And then the second one is being mindful of the feelings in your body. And then the third foundation of mindfulness is being mindful of mind itself. And then the fourth foundation of mindfulness is being mindful of the phenomena that comes to visit us in our mind, the phenomena that we create in our mind. And it's just as I've been hopefully sort of pointing to here, this mindfulness, these creations really are things that come about because of the way we perceive things, the way we feel things, and then the way that we come to believe in this, the way that things apparently are. But the meditation is all about looking deeply into that, just to look deep, look past that, just not to believe necessarily, just what it is that we think that things are. Because the Buddha was really more teaching that this mind itself is more like a continuum. The mind is not, you know, I mean, when you have this belief that the world out there is so fixed, so apparently truthful, when we think like that, it's just natural that you become born and then you see yourself dying and death, and then death does look like it's the end of things. But the Buddha's saying, no, that's not true at all. This mind is a continuum. The mind does continue. It's not. The mind doesn't die when the body dies. So, how do we understand that? And that's really where we do come back to this mindfulness, being mindful of just what we're looking at, being mindful of how we see and relate to this world. And as you start to practice that, and the four foundations of mindfulness start to be there, and then you've got the very first foundation of enlightenment in place then, once the mindfulness is there. Mindfulness is the first foundation of enlightenment. And then you can move on to the second. Once that's there and you're working with all that fairly right, in a fairly good way, you can then start to entertain and be with the second foundation of enlightenment, which is investigating. And that's really where I'm sort of going to in this talk. There's seven foundations of enlightenment, but there's this investigation is the second one. And I was just thinking very much about this week, because a couple of weeks ago I heard a chap on the radio was speaking on a Sunday Extra program that I sometimes listen to, and his name was Dr. I've just got his name written here. Very difficult for me to read. I hope you'll sort of forgive me for not being really good with my reading, but his name was Dr. Sam Palmier. And he was the associate professor in the Department of Medicine at New York, the Crossman Medical School. I just thought that I'd better write that down just so that you didn't think I was necessarily bringing this information in from nowhere. But he's been studying 2,000 what we call the near-death experiences, NDEs. And he studied 2,000 of those in this awareness study that he's been doing. And it just struck me as I was listening to him, because I mean, usually when you're listening to someone medical or scientific like this, they're usually very they don't sort of pay much heed to things spiritual so much. It's really more, you know, the scientific method, which I kind of totally believe in and agree with too, the scientific method. But it's very rare that you find people of that kind that sort of say necessarily controversial things. But this man did. That's why I sort of took notice of it. But he said he wanted to change the wording of NDEs. He didn't want to call them NDEs anymore because he said that they were, it was misleading. It was misleading to talk about people's experiences as near-death experiences. He said because they're not. They are, in fact, recalled experiences of death, he said. They're recalled experiences of death. This was how he put it. And in fact, he really surprised me further by saying that he'd been looking into seven English-speaking countries around the world and the populations, and just with, I guess, with some of the statistics from the hospitals and so on. And they've found basically that 11% of the people from those countries, those seven European and English-speaking countries, 11% had a near-death experience, NDEs. And he said that that equated to 850 million people. So you can see that just right there, this is not, it's not just a little thing, because now that medicine's starting to sort of move more in that direction of talking about things like this as recalled death experiences, then we really, you know, really do start to, it starts to give you the idea that maybe the mainstay of physics and science and medicine is really starting to sort of move a little bit more towards the reality of what we see in our meditation practice. Because to have a near-death experience really is nothing too new in people that practice, and certainly people that practice really, that are good, really good practitioners, that we can really look at this deeply. You know, it's not that, there's many people even in this society and indeed in our groups around the world that know all about what a jhana is. Ajahn Brahm teaches them so clearly and eloquently down at Jhana Grove, and the monastery teaches people how to do this. And you can see from there, there's the process in meditation there that I sort of talk about as calcination, where the aggregated compounded nature of our lives is kind of calcinated, where it sort of spins out and you know you come back to tours. You know, once the aggregation can start, you can start to see past it all and start to see that the body does drop away, to see that the mind stands forth in these practices. And you can notice that intuit very, very well just, you know, what it might like to have a near-death experience. All these things are really there for us to notice in our meditation practice. And that's, I think, a little bit, for me, it's always sort of been a little bit easier to sort of see the deconstruction, if you like, the deconstruction of your body, the deconstruction even of your mind in meditation. You can sort of practice with that. So it's sometimes a little bit more difficult, I think, to see the way that the mind sort of builds itself up, the way that it manifests, the manifestation of the way this body and everything comes into existence. But you can kind of work with all of that too. You know, there's so many, the lists that the Buddha made, you know, and the different ways that he kind of gave us these insights and ways into sort of seeing and working with all of this is just very, it's very powerful. Just looking at the 12 steps of a dependent origination, you can really start to see just the different stage by stage, just the way that things build up and the way that rebirth happens. and the way that this mind itself is quite, yeah, it's quite real, this continuum of the mind that sort of that this continues. So thinking about all of that, I think is really, well, for me, it's really quite interesting, and it really does play into this idea of the second factor of enlightenment. You know, where the investigation process is really taking place, and if we can kind of use the stillness of our mind and the wonderful clarity that comes. It's just astonishing, really, how you can kind of be with these things and really start to understand some of these things that the Buddha was pointing to, so that we're not necessarily just sort of caught all the time into this world, just believing what we see. And that particular show, that I'd encourage you all to have a look at that quantum show, because that's on from 2 nights ago, I think it was now, but it'll certainly be on ABC iView, and for those people that are not in Australia, if you can get to the internet, I think you'll find the Australian Broadcasting Commission does on their website have this facility called iView, and you can look that up yourself, look the show up yourself and run it. You'll sort of see there how they were showing very clearly in that show just how perception works. And how what we're really seeing and working with is not necessarily the be-all and end-all of everything that we know. That there are these questions that are there, the way that the brain itself fills in so much stuff. And that's really it's really important as we're kind of moving to understand these. The way the Buddha taught, you know, in these seven factors of enlightenment, we do that investigation, and there, from there, then we're moving down to the third factor again, back into this energy. Because once you start to get that energy going, especially from the investigation, and you start to get really still and quiet, that energy can really become quite focused, and especially when it becomes balanced, when it's balanced out. You know, I usually just look at that from the way that in our meditation, just looking at the five hindrances, because the third and the fourth hindrance is restlessness and sloth and torpor. So you're trying to balance this thing between you know, just being out there all the time with your restlessness, and then just wanting to drop off to sleep. But just when you can get that sort of nice balance of awareness and have that just sitting there, so that you can just look directly at your mind and just be with the stillness, it's just so compelling to see. And then, of course, once that energy happens like that, then you've got the opportunity for this joy and this. It's just really, you know, how to even speak about that. It's just such a subtle thing, but this a rapture and a joy that's you know, Ajahn Brahm's always talking about this, the bliss, because you're moving yourself into balance, and then if we're looking back at the hindrances, we're looking at the first and the second hindrance. That a desire and aversion of kind of abating, they're moving away, and we're just able to sort of sit with contentment, just sitting with absolute contentment, just to watch the stillness and be with the stillness of mind in a balanced, complete way. And the truthfulness of that is just so compelling. It does bring up this happiness and this joy, this rapture, that just makes you want to keep doing it, keep looking there, because you know that you're moving towards something quite special. You're moving towards truth. And then it's the fifth factor of enlightenment is really when all of this happens, and then you're gradually kind of just just allowing all that to be, and then there's this, you know, a tranquility, this tranquility that comes, where everything is just, you know, how to even explain that? Just being tranquil, when the mind's tranquilized like that, no drugs, nothing that you're taking. It's just the natural process of just being with the truth, being with this focused mind, this emptiness and this clarity that's there, and this tranquility is just overwhelming. Because you're totally aware, totally present, but just so tranquil. And then when that tranquility is there, then there's the opportunity to really have that deep concentration, to concentrate right through into, you know, full samadhi, full opportunity to really see deeply into the nature of what your mind is, the nature of who you are, the nature of this world that's sitting out there. And then, of course, the seventh factor of enlightenment is equanimity. And as I've mentioned here before, equanimity, I think, is really one that's we're really working to understand it, aren't we? What equanimity really is, just what it really means. I mean, on the face of it, we can sort of think about this in an intellectual way and just know, well, you know, that's we're talking about a balance here, just balance. But it is that subtle way that the mind can sort of hang on. You know, you've got this tranquility and you're there. And I'm sure that most of you probably would have, and probably the people looking in too, in meditation would have experienced this, where you kind of, you know, oh, this is just so blissful, so wonderful, and you're kind of just absorbing into this wonderful experience. But then there's maybe a little fear will pop up. Ooh, I'm not going to go down there. Ooh, I'm not going in there. This is really a bit too much. And those subtle kind of desires to want to hang on to this world, hang on to the external world, hang on to this body. Dennis is going to disappear down there. I don't want to go down there. And this equanimity really, I think, personifies that in a really subtle way. You know, it's sometimes very difficult to really come to terms with just exactly what equanimity is. And it just needs that, you know, just running over those whole seven factors of enlightenment again, just starting again at the beginning, just investigating and then going down and deeper and deeper and gradually, bit by bit, staying with it, to be with it. And you've got to really, I think too, you know, I just often look at Ajahn Brahm, who is really just a wonderful example for us all here at Dharmaloka and really the whole of the Buddhist society around the world, really. Such a wonderful example of someone that just, you know, he is... dogged, committedly dogged to just sit and be there. You know, as Ajahn Brahmali was saying to me, whether or not, you know, Ajahn Brahm will talk about, have you, you know, are you having a bit of problem with meditation? Well, no, with your meditation, have a few problems? No, just go back and sit a bit more. It's just, if ever you're looking for Ajahn Brahm, he's always in his cave. Because, you know, I think that, you know, the idea of sort of just living in this external world that really is so problematic, so full of dukkha. You know, I think I talked about this a little bit the last talk that I gave, where, you know, understanding dukkha itself is just so, it can be so difficult to really appreciate what the Buddha meant when he made the first noble truth. The very first thing that he uttered about Buddhism, the first noble truth, is that this world is full of dukkha, full of unsatisfactoriness, full of movement and disease. you could say disease or dis-ease, something where we can never be peaceful with it. We can never be peaceful with it. And I mean, events in the last week or so in Afghanistan, and not only that, I mean, just right, you know, we haven't had that many big wars lately. You know, we've had the First and the Second World War, which were sort of huge, but if you even think from then, from 1949 onwards, there's been any amount of trouble all the way through the world. It's very, very difficult for us to live with one another, to just be in relationship with one another, even though, you know, I think it seems to me that we're that probably the world is much more peaceful now than what it has been. But then you look at the events of the last week and the disappointments and the troubles that are around there, you see that this dukkha is really everywhere. It's not something that is just a plaything. It's just there caught. It's caught into the dualities. Whenever you get these ways of sort of seeing things, and always sort of caught up with those that axis going one way and then the other. It's just impossible to ever think that the world is going to be perfect. And this is really what we, I think, need to fully understand. Because the only way that really true peace can come to our lives is really by understanding what the Buddha talked about. And he said this often enough, more than once or twice, exhorted us all to the way that he said it was to say that the house of self is on fire. You know, get out as soon as you can. The house of self is on fire. To get out as soon as you can. So maybe I'll leave my comments at that and maybe we'll move into a meditation. But I would like to just sort of bring some of those aspects perhaps into the meditation, and we'll just follow the usual example of the way that we normally go by just looking at the foundations of mindfulness, first of all. So we'll look at our body first of all, and then maybe just trying to do a bit of anchoring, because it, you know, in saying all that I'm saying, it might sort of sound like that I'm kind of trying to eschew the world or get rid of the world, but it's not really like that. You can't do that. We need to sort of ground ourselves into who we are. I mean, we are part of this earth. We've got to really just start from where we are, start right now in this present moment, where we are. And when we're in this physical body, these elements that come from the earth. But not only that, they come from the wider universe. All of the elements themselves come from stars. We know that from physics, that all the elements come from stars. They come from these titanic explosions that are happening all the time in the universe. And however we want to, you know, physicists have their way of describing all that and the way that they kind of would want to see it. But once again, this is really a way of just making meaning of the world that we've got around. And it's useful, it's very helpful, and certainly it's good to do this grounding exercise like this to recognise all of that. But really we're wanting to go beyond, we're practising to go beyond all of that, to let it go. So I would encourage, especially at the end of this meditation, maybe if you can absorb deeply, if we can, or perhaps practice to absorb as deeply as we can into the mind, and then just when we're finishing the meditation, when we come back into the room, just to notice the way that this universe does just fall back into place. And that's why it's so important to have this stillness of mind, this still consciousness of mind, to know what that still consciousness is. So that when you know what that is, you can work with it. You can work with it, you can penetrate into it. And when you do penetrate into even still consciousness itself, you see that it finishes. There's nothing there. So, if you'd like to make yourself nice and comfortable. back nice and straight if you can, not ramrod straight, just very balanced and natural kind of way to sit. Right hand on the left with your thumbs just touching, breathing through your nose, top of the head pointing to the ceiling. And just anchor yourself into your position. And perhaps just take a couple of breaths. And then we will do a quick sweep through the body just to have a look at this second foundation of mindfulness, just where we're kind of looking at the feelings that are there in our body. And you can perhaps start with it's a cold night tonight, so I'm presuming everyone's got socks on. Can you feel your big toe against your socks, or your heel, or the arch of your foot? Just anywhere we would like to notice. Just feel that sensation around your feet. Feel the shape of your feet. Feel right into the skin. I often like to just feel into the calluses that's usually around my heels that usually need to be scraped. Feeling right into your feet and then moving up through the ankles. Feeling into that articulation that's there, the way that it bends to keep your foot and your leg nicely working. Then moving up through the lower legs into the calves, and I often talk about the soft calf muscles at the back and the hard shin bone at the front. Just noticing all of that. If you have trouble with the feeling of it, just try and notice it against some of the fabric that you're wearing, or maybe the air as it touches the skin. And as you go with this, you'll no doubt start to notice that there are times and places where your whole body will start to tingle. This is a sure sign that you're starting to relax. And just moving up through your knees and into your thighs, through your bottom, and just feeling the pressure there on your bottom as it's sitting on the seat. And then up into the tummy, the lower back. And when you've got time too, just to look at all that's going on in there, because it is possible to sort of notice the little gurgles and rumbles and little movements of everything that's sort of flowing around in your intestines. And then moving up into the upper chest and the back, around the shoulder blades. Perhaps just feeling your shoulder blades, and then you can bring your attention back to the more obvious things in the obvious organs that are there in your chest. Your heart and the rhythms that are there. And then just feeling the arms as they hang down by the sides. Moving through your elbows. Again, just using those little techniques to feel as you go, just feeling what your body's like. Into the forearms and the wrists and into the hands and the fingers. And again, as I've say around the fingers and on the hands, it's usually a very good place to notice the way the nerve endings tingle. Around the fingers. And once you get a sense of that, you can usually then look at other parts of your body, perhaps even around your toes, and just notice the tingling there too. These are the little movements, the anicca, the way that the body is constantly on the go, moving. It was nice to work with that tingling, because it certainly is a way of really enjoying, really starting to appreciate and even starting just to feel the rapture of what it's like when you relax fully. Your whole body is just like a ball of energy. And then moving your attention up into your head and around your eyes and your nose and your lips, up to the top of your head. There's usually always plenty of action going on at the top of your head too, a lot of energy there. And you can feel the way that we are grounded, firmly anchored onto this earth. Gravity is sort of working with us just to hold us here on this earth. We can be grateful for that, the gravity and the way that the earth provides all the elements, the oxygen and the nitrogen and the all the chemicals and elements that we need to sustain our life. We are part of this earth. And we can just reflect while we're doing this, just in the way that we are anchoring ourselves, we can also notice that we're connected too to this wider universe, up past the sun and the moon. And be grateful for the sun's influence on the earth, the way that it holds it in its movement, and the way the moon works with the tides and affects us with our bodies. All of these things so important. And then moving out further into the galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy. And just noticing that we are just a little speck here, and this whole galaxy is there supporting us. Then out beyond that, clusters of galaxies, the whole universe. You can realize and notice that while you're sitting here breathing, just breathing in and out, that the whole universe is there with you, supporting you. And then you can start to turn your attention more to the breath and notice that you're already starting to be quite still and relaxed. Just noticing the breath as it flows in and it flows out. Keeping the attention there. And then even with just this much, you can already notice that the hindrances are coming under control. You can notice that there's any desire that might have been there at the beginning, or aversions, notice that those first two hindrances are abating, they're moving away. And you notice that you are just content just to sit and watch the breath. Beautiful contentment, just feel what that's like, what it feels like to be contented. And then the third and the fourth noble truth, the third and the fourth hindrance, too, restlessness and sloth and torpor, are coming into total balance. You notice that you're sitting alert. You're kind of watching, being. You're not asleep. You're not restless or running away. You're just balanced with contentment. And how wonderful that feels, just to notice that feeling. And any doubts, the fifth hindrance, any doubts tend to be just dissipating because, you know, it's not, you're not worried about anything, not thinking about anything like that. Just contentment. And because that contentment is just there and you're starting to really enjoy it, just to be feeling the subtle nature of its pleasure. You just allow yourself to absorb more deeply. Perhaps even start just to see and notice the stillness of mind. Can you see that the mind is not thinking? It's not moving at all. And there is just this stillness that's there, this still consciousness. Quite palpable. To just notice what that feels like. And you can just keep the breath in mind, but if you like to, you can turn your attention more to the stillness. Just allow yourself to absorb into that. you might also now be able to notice that the breath, as it's flowing in and out, can be seen against that still consciousness. And just to notice that that still consciousness is really where this breath is coming from. The breath is beginning in that stillness. It's coming to its fullness. And then it's reconditioning itself and flowing out, just to end in the stillness. All of the functions of this breath are coming from the stillness and they're returning to it. Can you notice and see what that feels like? The words that I'm speaking, can you notice that they're coming from the stillness, only to finish in the stillness? Gradually, bit by bit, you start to see that the creation of all the phenomena that goes on, the phenomena that we're looking at as the fourth foundation of mindfulness, all that phenomena is moving out from the stillness, beginning, being born from the stillness, and is returning to finish in the stillness. It's beginning and ending. And we can start to intuit that all of the phenomena that arise from our five senses is all doing the same thing, arising from the stillness and finishing in the stillness. And we can know that what we're observing here is really nothing more than the second and the third noble truth. The phenomena that is filled with dukkha, the first noble truth, is being created and born out of the stillness, is the second noble truth, and then returning, finishing, dying. Into that same stillness. It's the third noble truth. And indeed, we're practicing with this investigation by using the fourth noble truth, which is the Eightfold Path of practice. So right here in this very simple meditation, right here inside each of our fathom-long lengths of body, we can notice that the whole universe is there, right here in the present moment. Beginning and ending. And just allow yourselves to savor, to wallow in this beautiful stillness, to really get to know it. Because in a moment I'm going to ring the bell and I'll leave the three resonances go as long as I can. But over the period of those three resonances, just allow yourself to reflect. And then as you open your eyes and you bring all of your five senses back into this apparent world, just see if you can notice the way that this world too locks into place around you as you're coming back from the unification that we've just been experiencing. As everything comes back to its aggregated position, its apparent place. Well, I don't know about you, but I feel so much better after that meditation. Running around in this apparent world before I got here and just being able to sit with you all is really quite a pleasure. And I trust that you all managed to get some value from that meditation, and hopefully you were able to notice too the stillness. That's there. This is a very gradual path that we're on here. It's just not something that you can necessarily just get right away. It's something we need to work at, to practice with. It's not easy, Dharma, the way that the Buddha taught. This world is very beguiling. This universe is a very beguiling place. it's so compelling, isn't it, to look out there. I mean, everything just seems so so real, so truthful. But as we examine our perceptions and examine our feelings and we look deeply into all of this, the nature of all of this, you know, we can really start to see that perhaps there's perhaps our beliefs, we can learn more about the world by just letting them go, even just for a moment, letting them be, letting them go. And just to try and understand what it's like when, what this world is like when we do let it go, when we can let it go. And just the peace that can be had in our mind. So, we're well over time again now, and just a reminder again that the care group line is open, and so anybody that would like to call in, they'll be there until 9 o'clock this evening. So if you would like to ring the care line, there are willing listeners there ready to take your call. So thank you everybody for your patient listening. We'll just pay respects to the Buddha, just for those that want to. We'll just bow 3 times, and then you're very welcome. I see Ron's already left to prepare the tea and the eats that are over in the kitchen. So it'd be lovely to catch up with you all over there and continue the discussion. Good night, everybody.